Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's occasional lecture. We meet here, of course, where others have met for thousands of years, so I acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land and pay respect to Indigenous elders past and present. Well, thank you for coming out today. It's a horrible day outside. I think tomorrow and Sunday are going to be even worse, but I'm sure that you will think that your effort today is very worthwhile. Thank you. Because today we have the great pleasure of welcoming James Fifner from the United States of America. He is currently working as a visiting scholar at Griffith University in Brisbane, but we've been able to tempt him down here to the cold of Canberra to speak to us about one of his many research interests. In the US, Jim is a university professor and director of the doctoral program at the School of Public Policy at George Mason University, which is on the doorstep of Washington, D.C. He is a highly renowned scholar and has an immense list of publications with a great deal of work in the area of the US presidency, public policy, national security, public administration, and topics that are of great interest to us as a group, as you know. So I'd like you to give a very warm welcome to Jim Fifner today to talk about dysfunctional politics in the United States, origins and consequences. Please welcome Jim Fifner.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction, and I would like to thank Rosemary, the Clerk of the Senate, for inviting me to do this lecture. It's a great honor to me, and I really appreciate it. I also want to express my thanks to Dr. Ann Tiernan at the Center for Governance and Public Policy at Griffith University, who set up the rest of my tour here in Australia. But most of all, I'm struck by the friendliness and helpfulness of the Australian people. Everybody has been so kind to my wife and me that we really appreciate it. And, of course, Australia is a spectacularly beautiful country, which we are really enjoying. And thank you all for coming out on this very rainy day. It doesn't seem cold to me, but it seems to be cold to some people here. So it's just been wonderful for us. Now, given the recent partisan developments in Australia, you might think that your politics are crazy, but I am here to reassure you that you've got it easy. Politics in the United States are much more crazy, and yours seem tame and reasonable to us. And I'd like to try to explain why that's so in the United States. The separation of powers in the United States Constitution created a system with many veto points, and usually it's been able to act when necessary. In the past, of course, we had a civil war, but most of the time we've been able to compromise enough to pass public policy. But in that past half century or so, the presence of divided government, and that means in the United States when one political party controls the presidency and the other political party controls one or two houses of Congress, it becomes very difficult and a hindrance to policymaking. But in recent years, the polarization of American politics, particularly in Congress, has really exacerbated this problem and leads to stalemate, deadlock, and so forth. For instance, the 113th Congress, which was elected in 2012, has been less productive than all previous Congresses up to this time, passing only 15 laws as of July 2013. Now, not, of course, that passing laws is a measure of good governance, but it becomes dysfunctional when Congress cannot compromise sufficiently to address important public policy issues in the United States. For instance, immigration reform is necessary. We've got 11 million immigrants, some of them legal, some of them illegal, but we've got to sort that out somehow. Congress is at a deadlock on that. The Postal Service continues to lose money, but the Democrats and Republicans can't agree on how to change it. The Postal Service wanted to stop mail delivery on Saturday, but Congress would not allow it. The Affordable Care Act, health care financing in the United States, was a big breakthrough, historic for the United States. the Obama administration got it through with Democratic support, but Republicans are trying to hinder it, and in the House has taken 38 votes to abolish the act. So we've got a real polarized situation there. But more politically contentious issues probably don't even have a chance. Gun control, abortion, climate change, and so forth are not likely to be dealt with by the United States because of this polarized deadlock. And more fundamentally, Congress has not been able to agree on fiscal priorities, with Republicans refusing to even consider any increases in taxes, and Democrats unwilling to accept any cuts in social programs unless there's also increases in tax revenues. So in my remarks, what I'd like to do is try to put this in context or historical context, and I want to comment particularly on three issues. One is the structural origins of polarization in the United States, the effect of that polarization on Congress, and the broader consequences for the United States political system. So the essence of the problem is that over the last several decades, Congress has become more politically polarized and evenly divided between the two parties. The Democrats are further on the left and more coherent. The Republicans are more coherent and cohesive and farther on the right. And this process of polarization and partisan realignment started with the transformation of politics in the south of the United States, which switched from Democratic control to Republican control several decades ago, and that has sort of set this dynamic on towards polarization. First, to begin, you have to understand the solid South in the United States. After the United States Civil War, the Republicans were in charge of the presidency. They sent down carpetbaggers, they were called, to the South to ensure that there was racial equality, blacks were treated equally, and so forth. And, of course, this was very much resented on the part of the South. But there was a deal made, okay, take your carpetbaggers back up north, leave the South to us, Democrats, and that was a deal that was made. And then the conservatives in the South proceeded to implement Jim Crow laws, which means racial segregation and so forth. So the Democratic Party in the early part of the 20th century was the party of segregation in the South, but the broader Democratic Party was much more liberal, the National Democratic Party. The Republican Party represented the Union, and they would not get any place in the South. But that changed, and that's what set this all off, and I want to explain a little bit about that. The National Democratic Party, as I mentioned, was much more liberal, the party of Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, social programs, Social Security, and so forth, and favored national governmental action in welfare, Social Security, federal education, housing, and so forth, and civil rights for African Americans, except for the Dixiecrat, that is the very conservative Southerners that were in the Democratic Party. So you had a Democratic Party that had both liberals and conservatives. So polarization began over several decades, Republicans becoming dominant in the South. So the roots of this, in Nelson Polsby, a famous political scientist in the United States, attributes this to the introduction of affordable air conditioning in the South. Now, this might seem a bit frivolous and a bit whimsical, but there's some data behind it. From the 1960s to the 1980s, 40 to 50% of Southern Republicans were born outside of the South. That meant they were coming from the North, good, solid Republicans, moving to the South and bolstering Republican Party in the South. At the same time, with urbanization, African-American voters, blacks, were moving to the North. And so if you combine this with other factors leading to this partisan realignment, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which increased the participation of African-Americans in voting in the South, and they were, of course, overwhelmingly Democratic, liberal. And this alienated white Southern conservatives who switched from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. Thus, conservatives in the South began to identify themselves as Republicans because they could actually win office as Republicans when they couldn't in the past. And this led to the realignment. African-American voters then became an important and still are a block of voters for the Democrats. Always 90-95% of African Americans vote Democratic now. However, after the voting reforms, there were a lot more black voters registered to vote in the South, But there were few black faces in Congress because maybe 15, 20% of the Southern population, and they're spread around, very few black faces. And so this led to the creation, a bipartisan agreement, of majority-minority districts in the South. That is, gerrymandering, which in the United States is changing congressional districts help one party or the other, changing the lines. You know, these voters are Democratic, these are Republican, and shifting it around. And often this is done very skillfully, and this is controlled by state legislatures in the South, or in all of the states. And so what this did was to create, and by legislation, majority-minority districts, and what this did was to pack African Americans into single districts so that there was a majority, and they could, in fact, elect black representatives to Congress. But by taking these liberal African Americans and packing them in one district, the surrounding districts became much more white and much more conservative. So this, in a sense, was a bipartisan gerrymander. Both political parties won. Democrats got more blacks in the Congress, and Republicans got more safer seats in the South for Republicans. Okay, so the effects of polarization on Congress was to create more cohesive caucuses, more Republicans, more conservative, Democrats, more liberal, particularly in the House of Representatives, because the Democrats no longer had these Southern conservatives in the party. Okay, and so in the 1970s and 80s, the Democratic Party controlled Congress. They wanted to pass laws, and they were dominated by liberals now, because remember, their conservative wing was now Republican. So it was much more homogeneously liberal. They wanted to pass laws. How do you pass laws in Congress? Well, you have to dominate the legislative process, and in doing so, they were often relatively heavy-handed, meaning not giving the minority much chance. And the Republicans saw this as a sort of repressive, shutting them down, not giving them a chance to offer amendments and so forth. And the Democrats, in a sense, were ramming through legislation. And this continued a partisan dynamic leading to more polarization. In doing this, there was, in a sense, a parliamentary arms race, which is still going on. The use of the filibuster in the Senate exploded. Now, the filibuster in the United States is a tradition and a rule in the Senate that any member can stand up and talk as long as he or she wants to in order to delay legislation. And so if you're in the minority and the majority is going to pass a law that you don't like, you can stand up and just talk forever. Now, in the past, in the mid-20th century, people did this in the sense that they held the podium, and Strom Thurmond, a very conservative senator, set the record at 24 hours, just about impossible to believe. But so it really carried out. But in the 1970s, rules were changed so that the rest of parliamentary Senate business could go along. And so now all they have to do, either party has to do, is say, I'm going to have a filibuster, and that stops legislation from going forward or even getting to the floor of the Senate. And it takes 60 votes to basically shut down a filibuster and actually get a vote on the merits of whatever it is. Now, both parties have used this, but the increasing use of it is it's getting worse, and right now the Republicans are stopping a lot of nominations. Executive nominations have to be confirmed by the Senate, and Republicans are saying, no, we're going to filibuster this. The Democrats only have 54 seats in the House, so they can't override the filibuster with 60 votes, and so it's really very contentious, and it, of course, leads to bitterness on both sides. And this also has led to a decline in civility in Congress in general. You know, the bitter enemies, which it used to be in the 1950s, members of Congress would treat each other with respect, even though they really disagreed with them. But in part, that was because air travel wasn't so easy. People were around the Senate. They went out to eat lunch, dinner with their colleagues across the aisle, and they saw each other as human beings that they disagreed with, as opposed to the enemy over there. But since then, with air travel becoming cheaper and the need to raise money, which is very important in the United States Congress, we don't have public support of election campaigns, and so members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate, and in the House every 2 years. And so they're continually out raising money, campaign funds, so that they can fund their next campaign. And they do that by going back to their districts. And so you have what's called a Tuesday-Thursday club during this when Congress is in session. They may come in on Tuesday and leave on Thursday, and so they don't get to meet members of the other of a, other party. And so all of this dynamic fits together in an unfortunate way to make things much more polarized. Okay, so that's the beginning of polarization. The line of analysis goes: air conditioning in the South leads to Northern Republicans coming to the South, plus majority-minority districts, plus the civil rights laws of the 1960s, leading to the Republican domination of the South, which makes the House caucus Democrats more liberal, and members of the Republican Party much more conservative and consolidated through these bipartisan gerrymandering. Okay, so now shifting to how this gets locked in the House of Representatives with much broader implications throughout the country, and this is the creation of safe seats. Every state has a certain number of representatives based on their population, and each state is drawn into single-member districts so that individuals are elected to Congress, to the House, on that basis. Okay, so the U.S. Constitution requires a census every 10 years. Because populations change, you know, different states, if you're increasing number of people in the state, you may get another representative, and the same thing on the other side if you're losing. Okay, so we've got to do the census and redistrict, and the people who set the district lines in the House of Representatives are the state legislatures. We've got a very strong federalism streak in America, as you do here. And so that's not set up by the federal government. That's set up by the state governments. And so the state legislatures draw these lines. And so this leads to the, okay, if one party or the other dominates, they want to do things that are best for themselves, create safe seats for themselves. But in doing this, it's often a bipartisan thing. You Democrats can have these districts. We'll draw them so that they're safe for you, meaning safe means a clear majority, 60%. It's always going to vote Democratic. Same thing on the Republican side. We'll create safe districts for ourselves. And this means that there's more safe districts. And, of course, they're not all safe, but they're increasingly safe. And this, as I want to explain, makes it very difficult and leads to even more polarization. It drives it deeper. Okay, so the dynamic is you've got primary elections. Who is going to run for Congress? Every district has to have, now it used to be long ago, early 20th century, that political parties decided, you know, pick the best person who's most likely to win. But in the United States, we now have primary elections, which means in order to decide who gets to represent, who gets to be on the ballot as a Republican or as a Democrat, depends on primary elections where people come out to vote. But it's not like everybody comes out to vote. As in a general election, even a general election when the presidency is up, only about 50% of the United States shows up to actually vote. Well, in the primaries, it's that much less. It's, you know, 20, maybe 30%. Okay, the people who actually come out to vote are those people who are most true believers, either liberal Democrats or conservative Republicans. And so if you're running for, if you want to be the nominee of the Democratic or Republican Party, the people you worry about are not sort of the moderate people in the middle, the reasonable people. You're worried about the people who are going to actually come out and vote, and those are the people that are most committed either on the left or the right. And so you're going to place yourself not in the middle, but you're going to be conservative if you're Republican, you're going to be Democrat, or you're going to be quite liberal if you're Democratic. And now, so the national parties do not control who is going to be the nominee. I mean, they can say we favor one person or another, but the voters get to decide. And an extreme example of this, and this has to do with party discipline, is that David Duke in the United States from Louisiana, explicitly racist, and this was like in the 1990s when, you know, mostly racism explicitly had been put aside and suppressed, but he was explicitly a racist. He wanted to run as a Republican nominee, And the National Republican Party said, you know, we don't want anything to do with this. This guy's clearly a racist. You know, we should vote for the Democrat. But they couldn't take him off the ticket. It was the voters in the primary elections that got to put him on a ticket. That's the law. He got the most votes, so he was on the ballot. So it's the voters that count. And, of course, in that case, it was extreme right-wing voters that came out and said, on the Republican, we were voting for David Duke. So what this does is to put moderate candidates of both parties at a disadvantage. You know, if you're a moderate in a safe district, you're not likely to win. Now, if you've got a competitive district, you know, 50-50 split, then moderates make a difference because there's a lot of people that are in the middle. But in safe districts, even though there might be a majority of moderate people in the middle, they don't get to vote for a moderate. They get to vote for whoever the political party gets onto the ballot through the primary election. So what this means as a consequence is if in the House of Representatives, you're always looking over your shoulder, to your right shoulder if you're a Republican, because you're afraid that you're going to get outflanked on your right by a nominee. So you're, you know, and it gets... So, and the same thing on the left. But if you're, say, a Republican and you vote for a bill in Congress that President Obama is in favor of or likes, you, the next time you're running for re-election, which is going to be, remember, every 2 years, somebody on your right may very well come up and say to the voters, look, this guy is a sellout. He's willing to vote for something that Obama is in favor of. Elect me, and I'll be sure to uphold our values and not vote for anything that might help President Obama or the Democrats. Similar on the left, only not quite as hard. So the real electoral threat comes from these people, to members of Congress from the right or the left in safe districts. Competitive districts, again, as I said, moderates do have a chance. Okay, so by the end of the 20th century, the parties were firmly polarized, particularly in Congress. Results of the House elections are revealing. In 2004, the House of Representatives had safe 83% of House races were won by more than 20%. Now, that's a landslide by anybody's measure. 95% were won by more than 10%. So this means most seats in Congress are safe with that polarizing dynamic that I just described. The re-election rates in the House are very high because incumbents have inherent advantages, name recognition. They can send back notes to their constituents saying these wonderful things that I've done, voted for in Congress, and so forth. And those are advantages, but the real advantage is in the safe seats. In 2002, the re-election rate for members of the House of Representatives running again was 96%. In 2004, it was 97%. So it's almost a sure thing if you're in the House and you're running for re-election, you're going to win. But you're also careful not to get outflanked on your right or your left. So as a consequence in Congress, moderates are vanishing, a vanishing breed. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you had this overlap in Congress, Democrats and Republicans, but there were conservative Democrats, there were liberal Republicans. But gradually, through this dynamic, and also members of Congress, moderates becoming just turned off by very hostile politics, gradually kept apart, moved apart, so there's hardly anybody in the middle in the House or the Senate, rather than that overlap. And if you have the overlap, you get people that are willing to work with the other side, willing to compromise and so forth. But with very few people left in the middle, it's much more difficult. And that's part of this polarization problem that that I'm describing. So polarization is reinforced by bipartisan gerrymandering. Now, ironically, though, in the United States, the political elites are very much polarized, and particularly members of Congress, but all politicians leaders of political groups and so forth, they're pretty much polarized. But the masses of Americans, most Americans, are not. They place themselves in the middle of a spectrum. You know, there's lots of public opinion polls say, would you consider yourself a strong liberal, strong conservative, and so forth, and most people are in the middle. And that's the irony. And some people say it's, some political scientists say, well, Congress is polarized because the American electorate is polarized, but most evidence indicates that the electorate is not polarized. It's these safe seats and these other dynamics that are leading to polarization of political elites. The media helps this along by trying to be balanced and also interesting. And so if you go talk to somebody about, say, a hot-button issue like abortion, and, you know, you don't talk to somebody and say, well, this is difficult, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, and so forth. You go talk to somebody on one side who says, you know, we should never allow abortion if you have laws against it. On the other side, you find, you know, to balance that off, you find somebody who says, anytime, for any reason, whereas most Americans are right in the middle, but that doesn't make interesting news. And so the media play into this polarization also. And so even like the hot-button issues like abortion, gun control, gay rights, stuff like that, most Americans are in the middle. But the political leaders, you know, if you want to run for Congress and you want to get your side all stoked up to give you money, you get on one side or the other of this and you say, if the other side wins, it's going to be terrible, things are going to fall apart, you've got to give me money so that I can get reelected, you've got to come to the polls and get me elected in the primaries. One sort of interesting irony, gun control in the United States, 80 to 90% of the people consistently in public opinion polls are in favor of some sort of a gun control registration or background checks, some sorts of limits. But the National Rifle Association in the United States is so powerful, and it can put lots of money into any district, Republican or Democrat, to run against somebody as somebody who is against anybody who wants any sort of control, who's coming to take away your guns. And they've framed it very effectively so that if you know, say you're interested in assault weapons and you should ban assault weapons or for magazines with more than 30 or 50 bullets or whatever it is, they're able to frame this as they're coming after you and who is the target shooter or maybe a deer hunter who's had rifles in your family for years, and you get afraid, oh my gosh, if they elect so-and-so, they're going to come and take all of our guns away. And so it's a very nothing's going to happen on gun control despite Sandy Hook. Very difficult. Democrats, of course, are in favor of some sorts of gun control, but they can't go very far. John Kerry had to go out in running for president, and so it showed that he was a pheasant hunter. Those are one of those things in American politics that might not make sense to you despite, 90% of the people in favor of it, but those are the dynamics of American politics now. Okay, and so what this does is to bring us to policy paralysis in a sense. The dynamics of polarization lead to more disciplined voting. So if the parties are fairly even in Congress, which they are, there's a lot of pressure to vote with the party, party discipline. Now, in parliamentary systems, party discipline is pretty clear. In the United States, it has always been much more fuzzy. People would occasionally go vote with the other side, moderates in the middle, and so forth. But now that is tending to disappear because the stakes are so high. And the argument from the party is, look, one or two defections could send it off and let the other side, who is basically evil, win, and we can't afford any defections at all. So in the United States, ironically, this is bringing us a bit more to a parliamentary system with a lot of party discipline. But what in a parliamentary system, if you've got a majority or a coalition majority, you can actually pass laws. In the United States, this kind of party discipline with polarization leads to trying to stop the other party. And if, as now, say, the Republicans hold the House of Representatives, Democrats have the Senate and the presidency, they can, propose all sorts of bills if they want. But if they can't get through the House, it's not going to become law. And so that kind of veto is possible in the separation of power system, which is, one of the problems with it that it has, maybe many benefits, but this is one of the real problems with the separation of power system. So this leads to more conflict. Republicans in the House have used the budget to force Democrats to try to cut programs, going so far as to threaten to default on U.S. Treasury bonds, sort of saying, you know, if you don't agree to deep cuts in social programs, we're going to, you know, we're going to default on bonds. And Democrats saying, well, no, we'll consider deep cuts or cuts in social programs if there's also tax increases, but the Republicans will say absolutely not. And so we've got that fiscal kind of problem, which, you know, we've got a deficit problem and in the longer run a national debt problem, but those things are not being addressed because of this polarization. And, you know, again, public majorities consistently favor compromise, some kind of combination of tax increases and spending cuts, and they would just as soon see a compromise, but the members of Congress are so polarized that it is not happening. So, again, just mentioning some of the difficult things, health care reform, the Republicans want to repeal it or slow it down, throw sand in the gears. Climate change is probably not going to happen. Immigration is very contentious, a very difficult kind of issue. And it's interesting now that the right wing of the Republican Party is dead set against immigration reform. But the people in Republicans that are thinking of the next 5 or 10 years are saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we've got to compromise a little bit here because the Hispanic vote is very large. We've got to try to appeal to them. We've got to broaden our appeal. That's the right is keeping that from happening. Now, it might happen sometime this summer, but the fight is a very fierce one. Abortion politics is now playing out in the states. Gay marriage is also playing out in the states. Gun control, I mentioned, is not going to happen. Okay, so and because both parties, and particularly the Republicans, see any kind of compromise as an abandonment of principle. Okay, so with that background, I'd like to bring this up to date through the 2012 elections and some of the implications here. In 2012, the presidential primaries, again, dominated by the Tea Party, the people that are gung-ho in the right, really forced Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee, further to the right. Now, jump ahead to the outcomes and then go back to that campaign dynamic. The outcome, President Obama won re-election, 51% of the vote. It was a clear win, but a very close a campaign. In 2012, the Democrats picked up 2 seats in the Senate and 8 seats in the House, which leaves them with 54 seats in the Senate, not enough to overcome a filibuster, about 2,001 seats in the House, 234 Republicans. They've got a clear majority in the House of Representatives. And the turnout for the United States was relatively high, 59%. Okay, you've got compulsory voting here, and that, I think, has an effect on your politics. In the United States, if we had compulsory voting and we had a turnout of 90%, the people who are not voting are the people who are in the middle, don't want to be bothered, are not that engaged, but the key is, or they're disaffected, but the key is that they're all moderate. If they were gung-ho and felt really strongly, they'd be out there voting. And so in the United States, if we had compulsory voting, I think it would make politics much more moderate because there'd be more people willing to vote for people who are moderate. But we don't have that, and that's part of the problem, and I think one of the good aspects of Australian politics. Okay, increasing number of safe districts in the House. In 1992, there were 103 competitive districts. In 2012, there were 35. Most seats in the House are relatively safe. Now, this doesn't mean, you know, if there's some big swing to the right or the left, seats can change. But without one of those large swings, it's going to stay the same, and it's one party, it's not likely to swing one way or the other. Landslide districts, in 1992, there were 124. Landslide, you know, 60% of the vote or more. In 2012, there were 242. So almost a doubling of the number of landslide districts, which is just an indicator of safe seats. 106 candidates won with more than 70% of the vote. Again, an indicator of safe seats. Okay, so the 2012 presidential campaign and dynamics, and a bit of speculation about 2014. The state of the economy was the biggest problem for President Obama and for any president in the United States. Any sitting president, the incumbent suffers if the economy is doing well or doing poorly. And they benefit if the economy is doing well, but presidents really don't control the economy very well at all. But nevertheless, it's a very important topic in the United States. It affects elections. If things are going bad, people want to throw the bums out and bring somebody else in who, of course, promises that they're going to fix it. And so that was an initial deficit, definitely a problem for President Obama as a sitting president. Now Mitt Romney was able to sort of focus in on that and say, the economy is getting worse. Elect me. I'm a business man, and I can, you know, run things business-like, we'll turn the economy around, and so forth. Both Democrats and Republicans claim that, you know, they can't do it, but nevertheless, it's a very powerful argument. But the main problem, challenge for Mitt Romney, was that he had to win in the primary elections. Okay, so the primaries, again, who is going to be the nominee for the Republican Party for the presidential nomination? And that's determined by primary elections. Now, President Obama didn't have to worry about that because no Democrat was going to attack him or try to unseat him. If they had, he would have had to move further to the left in order to win those, the Democrats that actually come out and vote in the primaries, but he didn't have to worry about it. But Mitt Romney did. Okay, so Romney is basically, has been a moderate governor of Massachusetts, a very pragmatic sort of reasonable person, but he had to get elected to be the nominee of the Republican Party. And as I said before, the people who come out for the primary elections, both sides, are those that are truly committed. And the Republican side, that means Tea Party people who are extreme right wing in the Republican Party and an important piece of the Republican a coalition. So Romney had to play to his right. He had opposition from a number, three, four, or five different candidates who are much further to the right. And so they would go out and say, elect me or nominate me. I'm true conservative and on all of these issues. And then Romney couldn't say, well, I'm sort of a moderate, reasonable person and I'll make compromises and we'll run the country well. He had to demonstrate that he was really as conservative as they were. He called himself a severe conservative. And he had to reject the health care financing plan that had been implemented under his rule as governor of Massachusetts. And the Democratic plan that passed under President Obama was based on that plan in Massachusetts. He had to distance himself from that in order to win the primary nomination in the Republican Party. And now he was able to do that, but in doing that, he had to move pretty far to his right, and that made it difficult for him in the general election to move back towards the center. And this is a common dynamic in American presidential politics. Just to give you a sense of the conservatism in the Republican Party, 30-35% of Republicans think President Obama is a Muslim and born in Kenya. So that, you know, and a lot of these people are the Tea Party people, and they're sort of libertarian, they're anti-big government, and they're conservative, but they're very important to the Republican coalition. And it didn't help Mitt Romney. There was a few gaffes in which he said things that highlighted that he was very well off. You know, he mentioned that 47% of the people are not going to, don't care about me. They're being irresponsible. They will never take care of themselves. I could read the quote. I won't. But it was to a private a meeting of fundraisers and so forth. But somebody had sneaked in there and recorded it. And that sort of reinforced what the Democrats were trying to paint him as sort of an uncaring plutocrat. But interestingly, the Republicans in the primaries had charged the same thing. You know, Mitt Romney is rich and he's out of touch and so forth, basically doing the work for the Democrats that the Democrats would pile on in the general election and say the same thing. So that was a very difficult thing for Romney to overcome, and in the end, of course, he didn't overcome it. The GOP Republican coalition in the United States, now there's some difficulty there. Who are the in terms of It's changing. Demographics are changing in the United States. So the supporters of Republican are people who are older. They tend to be married. They tend to be religious. So the very religious in the United States, whether no matter what the denomination is, if you go to church more than once a week, you're almost certainly a Republican. This is just one of those ironies, or not ironies, but facts of American politics. You can predict it. People who are, you know, secular or non-believers and so forth tend much more to be Democrats. So, and that's part of the religious is part of the an important part of the Republican coalition. Social conservatives also, but there's also the problem of demographics in terms of population balance in the United States. Republican House districts are 75% white. House Democratic districts are 51% white. Now, certainly this doesn't mean that all whites are conservative or racist or anything like that, but most people who are really conservative, who are white. And so it's a challenge to the Republican Party to reach out to blacks to get their support in elections, because blacks, African Americans, see the Republican Party as less friendly and the Democratic Party as much more friendly. So as I said, 90%. But Hispanics in the United States are growing a part of the population, an important part, and they generally see the Democrats as being more sympathetic to them, and particularly on immigration control, immigration reform. The Democrats sort of are on the left there saying, we've got to do something about this, but the far right is saying, no, you can't do that. And so this presents a problem for Republicans. Their demographic is disappearing. Now, this isn't going to happen, you know, before 2016, but over the longer run it is. And so you've got people who are Republicans and thinking of the long-term interests of the Republican Party, like Jeb Bush, who is a brother of George Bush, coming out and saying, well, we've got to do immigration reform. And other Republicans are saying that, but they're being fought by the right wing of their party. And even Karl Rove, who was the campaigner, fundraiser, specialist for George W. Bush, who's still very active, has been raising money, ironically, to run in the primaries against the far-right Tea Partiers, because he thinks that they are making the Republicans less electable. And over the last couple of sessions, there have been three or four Senate candidates who had in the primaries, were able to unseat more moderate conservative Republicans, but they were perceived as so far to the right that it helped the Democrats, and the Democrats beat them because they were running against somebody who's so far to the right. And so Karl Rove is saying, you know, those people are undermining our ability to take power. What we've got to do is have more moderate candidates. And so this is an interesting coalition problem, the coalition of the Republican Party. Yesterday, Elizabeth Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter, announced she was going to run for the Senate in Wyoming. Wyoming is a very conservative state, a very small state in terms of population. And the problem, of course, is that the sitting member is very conservative, a very solid conservative for many, many years. And so she is challenging him from the right. And so the Republican, this is probably not going to help the Republican parties to have this internecine fighting between somebody who's on the far right and somebody who's on the far, far right. And that's sort of a dynamic that's playing out throughout the United States. And of course, Democrats have problem with their coalition also, but this is striking at this time in American history. The Democratic coalition, generally younger people, single people, liberals, secular people, minorities, as I said, particularly blacks, African Americans, and Hispanics. So the long-term demographics favor Democrats, but that's no guarantee that they're going to win in 2014 or 2016. Just to speculate just a bit about 2014 in concluding my remarks here. In the House of Representatives, I feel very safe in predicting that the Democrats are going to lose seats in 2014. The party in power that has the presidency always loses seats in the midterm elections. Only three exceptions in the 20th century, 20th and 21st century. So almost for sure, the Democrats are going to lose some seats. And it's also a second midterm election, so it's 6 years into the Obama presidency, and this plays into Americans sort of, throw the bums out. The challengers have all of these targets. So Obama's done all these terrible things to the country and so forth. Elect us, and that has some cachet with the American electorate. And so I feel very safe in saying that the House Democrats are going to lose seats in the House. They would have to pick up 17 to get a majority. Not going to happen. And so in the Senate, there's 33 seats up for re-election, and the Democrats have to defend 20 of those. And so the odds, again, just looking at that, are in favor of the Republicans in terms of the Senate. The Democrats may be able to keep control of the Senate, but no way can they keep control of the House, which, of course, is going to leave either a there's definitely going to be a Democratic House or a Republican House. Senate may go either way, and of course, President Obama will be there, but he'll be a lame duck, and he's had a hard enough time already in his second term, despite a very solid reelection, getting anything through Congress. Well, it isn't going to get any easier towards the end of his term. He's going to be seen as a lame duck, and so it's going to be very difficult. Now, of course, in politics, anything could happen. There could be a terrorist attack, and Obama could either do great or he could do poorly. That could affect things. Anything could happen. But if nothing unusual happens, that's most likely what will happen. So my political forecast is more deadlock with intermittent crises in the United States. So thank you for your attention. I'd be glad to hear your comments and take questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that extremely lucid explanation of American politics. I understand it a significant amount more than I did.
Anybody who thinks they understand American politics is extremely uninformed.
I qualified it more than I did. If you would like to ask a question, I'd invite you to come to the microphone at either side of the auditorium. And gentlemen on my right, you have the first call.
Thank you, Professor, for your presentation. Over 100 years ago, a politician of Irish extraction called Plunkett put together a tome called Plunkett of Tammany Hall. And one of the classic chapters was on the congressman. And it started like this. The congressman is a hog. Take a stick to him and beat him over the snout with it. Have things improved?
Plunkett... the guy of honest graft and Tammany Hall, which was a machine, a political machine in the state of New York that really controlled everything, and they controlled the money and so forth. And a lot of that was putting people of your party in power, jobs, and so forth, relatively corrupt. And in terms of controlling members of Congress, hitting them on the snout with a 2x4 or something, it catches their attention. But the dynamics are, the way you do that, as I said, in the United States now with the safe district is, if somebody comes from your right. And so if you're a moderate, you don't have that 2x4 to smack them with. And so it can't catch their attention if you're a moderate. On the other hand, if you're on the far right or the far left, you've got that 2x4, which basically is a threat, for the next primary election. If you don't elect me and I'm going to be a true blue conservative or Democrat. So the people on the wings have that 2x4, but the people that are in the middle don't.
Thank you. Gentleman on my left for a question.
I follow Foxtel every night for its entertainment. It has turned me into a historian of civilizations. So coming here, I prepared myself. I said, there's a trinity of woes I'm going to raise. One is the Tea Party, which you did. The second one was the original sin of slavery, which you started your talks with, talking about the South, and you covered the guns. So I've covered my three items, and you've done them so beautifully, but you've left out the question. Where does the civilization of the USA go to?
Thank you. And I think, you know, you put your finger on very difficult fissures in American politics. The Tea Party, interestingly, they're not really a political party, and many of them don't want to be seen as part of the political party. They see themselves as sort of objecting. On the other hand, they're in favor of conservative Republican parties, and the Republican Party is counts on them very much to be part of their coalition. And so the Republican Party, even if the leaders want to be sort of moderate and do some compromising, are stuck with their very important a faction there. And so that's part of it. And, of course, slavery is the original sin in the United States. I think a lot of that has changed the laws over the last several decades. My children just don't have a feel. When I was young in the 1950s, there was real segregation in the North as well as the South. It was terrible. There was a civil rights revolution in the United States. And so Republicans are not racist. And very few people in the United States are really racist. Nevertheless, the dynamic of African Americans in the U.S. politics it is a very real one. It doesn't mean racism, but it's still real there. And of course, guns are one of those things that are just hopeless in the United States. When I went to Washington in the early 1970s, I was walking down 16th Street towards the White House and sort of looking around, and I looked up at this big building that looked like a bank, huge pillars and, five or six stories tall, and it was just, and at the top it said NRA, National Rifle Association. All of a sudden it clicked in my head, that stuff I've been reading in textbooks, that makes sense. Those people really are powerful. So it's a very effective political weapon that can be used. As to the effect on civilization, I would hope that our politics are very contentious and polarized, but I think our civilization is still there. And in Australia, you're setting a very good example. But I don't think it's completely the end of Western civilization in the United States, as difficult as our politics are.
On the right, thank you.
Professor, do you think that the dynamics of the electoral college system compound what you've said? So what I have in mind is that in virtually all states, there's a winner-take-all system, which means that in practice, attention is directed to certain states, such as Colorado, and not to other states. I was wondering if a proportional representation system were used within the electoral college system, wouldn't there then be a greater requirement to take into account the views of people throughout the nation?
Yes, the electoral college system in the United States now is not a college, but what it means is the president is elected not by the popular vote, but by electors. Each state has the number of electors in their congressional delegation, plus two for the Senate. And each state, after about the 1830s, has decided that it can get the most leverage of its electoral votes by putting them all in one basket. Okay, so all you have to do is get the most votes in one state in order to get all of their electoral votes. So Virginia has, say, 11 electoral votes. And if you get 51% of the vote, Democrat or Republican, you get all 11. It's not done by proportional representation. And so what that means is that if you can get the large states and you will get a big chunk all at once. And proportional representation would reduce that. So the Electoral College results in a focus on the swing states, as he mentioned. Okay, so this last election there was about 9 swing states, and the rest were basically safe one way or the other. Okay, so Texas is safely Republican at this time. California and New York are safely Democratic. And so the candidates for president don't go very much to those states, even though they're very large, they've got very large, lots of electoral votes, because it's a done deal. They know that the Republicans are going to take Texas. And so Democrats don't go there to campaign very much, whereas, maybe the Democrats might get 40% of the vote. And in Texas, it's all of those votes are not added up with all the rest of the Democratic votes in the country. It's just at the state level. And so this causes presidential candidates not to swing throughout the country, but to focus on the few states that might go one way or the other. And this time it was about 9 states, and they spent all of their time there. With proportional representation, you know, if you've got 40% of the votes in Texas, you get 40% of their electoral votes, and that would make presidential candidates, you know, worry about, you know, so Republicans would go to California and say, you know, campaign hard to get 40-45% of the vote, whatever it was, because it would help them. As it is now, with all of those votes in one basket, you know, they know if they get 49%, it's not going to do them any good. And so that, I think, is one of the problems. Personally, I have written in favor of doing away with the Electoral College. You know, I think the person who gets the most votes should win. But in the United States, it's not that way. And most of the time, the person who wins the majority of the votes does win the presidency. But a few times, it hasn't, about 4 times in U.S. history. And one of those 4 times was George Bush versus Al Gore in the 2000 election. Gore won 500,000 more votes totally in the United States than Bush did, but it came down to Florida. It was very close there to 527 votes or something. And interestingly, Ralph Nader, the Green candidate, won a couple of million votes there. And if you think that the Greens normally would have voted Democratic, which they most of them probably would have, Gore would have been president. But he wasn't because of the Electoral College. And so that's my criticism of the system. But there was an amendment proposed in Congress to change this in the 1960s. It got through one house, but not the other house. It's just not likely to happen because the calculation is, how is this going to affect my party, Democrat or Republican, next time? And everybody sees that there's too much risk of change there. And so it's not likely that that's going to change in the United States. But it's one of those anomalies that's a reality. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you very much. That was both very interesting and very depressing. I wanted to ask a little bit more about this business of primary voting, which is a fairly unique feature to America. Your analysis suggests that it ought to be blindingly obvious to moderates that they ought to get off their bums and go out and vote in the primaries. So is your analysis very new, and is your analysis kind of not widely disseminated? I mean, why doesn't that response happen?
Well, because, it's hard to get moderates out to vote. I mean, there are plenty of moderates in both parties that do vote, but they don't have a chance to win. There aren't moderate, well, in safe districts, there aren't moderate candidates to vote for. And so convincing them to do that is very difficult because the system is loaded in favor of the people who actually do turn out. Now, if the political parties were in charge, you might have a situation where the professionals would say, well, we want to get somebody that's moderate in the middle, more likely to win, and so forth. This happened in presidential politics in the early 20th century. But once you turn it loose to the voters, Democratic voters or Republican voters, it's very difficult to get everybody to turn out. But even if the moderates turned out in a safe district, it's still they could only vote for one candidate or the other, and those would probably be polarized. Now, it's always been that way, but it's much worse now because there are more safe districts now due to redistricting, and so the consequence of that is much greater now than it was in the past. Some states have said, well, let's have a nonpartisan commission of former judges draw district lines and so forth. That might help at some point in the future. But it's also, it's not a simple thing to draw districts that are evenly split. It's easy to draw them so that you're pretty clear that they're loaded one way or the other. Even if you had nonpartisan commissions, I'm not sure it would solve that whole problem. And polarization is built into the American political class pretty strongly now. So the safe seats, it keeps that going, but it's not the only cause.
This will probably have to be our last question. Go ahead.
Thank you. Professor, I wondered if you could just comment on the legislative innovation or otherwise around the Farm Bill. And does this redefining the scope of the issue offer a pathway forward through gridlock?
Okay, the Farm Bill in the United States it basically has been a deal between big agribusiness, which gets a lot of support, money, billions of dollars support, and liberals who are in favor of food stamps, that is, a subsidy for poor people who don't, you know, their income is below a certain level for a family of two or three or whatever it is. And so liberals favor that, a social program to help poor people. Republicans favor big business and farming interests. And, of course, you know, even if you're a liberal in the Midwest where you've got large wheat fields and so forth, you can't be against the farm bill. And so this was a sort of a combination that got the farm bill, which is worth quite a few billion dollars, to pass every year. But recently, in the last time, the Republicans in the House said, okay, they're having difficulty, you know, the House and the Senate coming to an agreement on this, and so the House said, okay, let's take the food stamps and set them over here and just vote on the farm bill, which basically just says, okay, vote, you Democrats, vote for our piece of this, which is a support for farmers and large businesses. And the Democrats say, well, no way, because, you know, what you're trying to do is take food out of the mouths of poor, hungry people and so forth. And that's where it stands now. But it is interesting and striking that, you know, log rolling and pork barreling, you vote for our stuff, we'll vote for yours. Even something as solid as that as in the farm bill is now hung up and cannot pass because of this polarization and Republican refusing to go along and pulling the food stamps out of it. So it's a symptom of the polarization that I've been talking about. Thanks.
Time is up. It's been illuminating and energizing, and it's given us a whole new perspective on dysfunctional politics that I'm sure we'll be able to think about for the rest of the day at least. Please join me in thanking Professor Hickman. And thank you all for coming out.